Come and talk to us, Abdu.
Well, thank you, Dick, for that introduction. And thank
you. Putting through the exercise so they can jump rope and so
forth. Right, exactly. I need a little bit of that. I could use some. Well, wow, thank you all for inviting me here and having me here at this this wonderful forum. I see quite a gathering here. It's going to be a little bit of a dance here. I'm a roamer, by the way, so you're going to have your hands full today. I like to walk around when I speak. And I'm a Lebanese, so my hands will go a lot of waving. I'm from the Mediterranean, man. We speak with our hands. If I have to hold a microphone, it's quite literally me doing my job with one hand tied in front of my back, so to speak. My name is Abdu Murray, and the first thing you're going to ask is, Abdu and Murray, what? Lebanese and Scottish? How did that happen? And the answer basically is this, is that my last name is really Murray. But when we came over to this country, they basically said, what's your last name? We said, Murray. And they said, okay, Murray sounds similar. So now I'm Lebanese and Scottish, which means I fight with everybody. As I begin my story, I want to talk about the story of my journey from Islam to Christ, and I'm very specific in how I actually word that. That wasn't a mistake. I don't mean Islam to Christianity. I don't mean religion A to religion B. I mean Islam to Christ. Islam is a way of life for Muslims. It is a holistic system of life when it comes to the rules that govern almost every aspect, depending on how conservative or how entrenched in the Sharia law you are. It governs everything, how you dress, what you eat, all these things. But it's in this desire to be obedient to God. But Christianity has that set of standards and principles, but it's marked by a relationship with that very God. And that's a very different thing, I think, when you come to that worldview of Christianity. So I'm not playing games with the words. I really mean sincerely Islam to Christ. But as I begin to tell you the story of how this all happened and how it took 9 years for that journey to happen, and I'm sorry, I just want to make sure I turn my thing off here so you guys don't have to hear about text messaging going off. I want to tell you another story about, I can tell lawyer jokes because I am a lawyer, and if there's lawyers in the room, I apologize. I don't want to apologize. You can take it. So you can take a little ribbing from a fellow lawyer. But there's a story, it proves a point. There's a story about this guy. He's a lawyer, and he made his millions actually sort of doing the quintessentially stereotypical things that lawyers do. You know, he lies and he cheats and he steals and all these things, and he does all these things, but he claims to be an upstanding person. So hypocrisy is a big part of his life. Well, one day he's out and he's going out at one of these large, sprawling ranch-type things we have here in Montana, and enjoying nature and seeing the beauty of the land that he's bought with all of his millions. And, you know, the leaves are falling from the trees and the squirrels are acting squirrely and the rivers are flowing and doing what rivers do. And he's enjoying the nature around him. He sees a bear in his path. And the bear is hungry and it strips its teeth and it snarls. And now he knows he's in trouble. So he begins to run as fast as he possibly can away from the bear. But the bear is faster than he is, and so it catches up to him and it knocks him over. And as he goes to sort of shield himself, he says, oh my God, and the bear stops, right in the middle. And the leaves stop falling, and the squirrels stop being squirrely, and the rivers stop flowing. Everything stops, and a light shines down from heaven. And that light says, you have denied me your whole life. You have acted as if I didn't exist, and you blaspheme me over and over again. Why should I save you now? And the lawyer, who can find a loophole, says, it would be hypocritical to become a Christian now, wouldn't it? How about this? Can you make the bear a Christian? And God's not going to be out-lawyered by the lawyer. He says, very well. And then the light goes back up, and the leaves start to fall. The squirrels get squirrely. The bear puts his paws together and says, thank you, Father, for this food I'm going to receive. Now, I tell that story to prove a point, actually. Sometimes when you're on the path and truth confronts you, right in your path, and there's no avoiding it. When the truth confronts you, sometimes it hurts. And I can tell you this from my own perspective, as someone who was very steeped in Islam and wanted, I had this idea that it's true and you should believe it because you should believe true things. But sometimes when you're confronted with a counter perspective, a counter worldview, it's very much like running into the bear because it's there, it's obvious, and there you have it. And then you try to squirrel your way around it, get your way out of this predicament you find yourself in, only to realize that the more you try to struggle against the truth, it's that resistance to it that hurts the most. I can tell you of people from all walks of life, whether it's Islam or Hinduism or atheism or secular humanism or different nominal Christianity, whatever it is, when they're confronted with the truth of the gospel and they're finally having to deal with the fact that I've been wrong all this time, it's not an easy journey. So if you were to get one thing out of the talk today, I hope it's that you get an understanding of what it means to come from a counter perspective, a counter worldview, be confronted with the truth in an intellectual and in an existential way, and realize how absolutely difficult it is to embrace that truth, how hard it can be. Well, I spent most of my life as a proud Shiite Muslim. Now, the real word, the way you say it is Shia. And of course, now with the news being what it is across the United States and across the world, in fact, what's happening overseas, we know that there are Shia and there are Sunni Muslims. The Sunni happen to be the majority. About 70 to 80% of Muslims around the world are Sunni. Then there's a large minority called the Shia. And there's some differences, but most of the theological differences are minor. For the most part, they agree on most of the orthodoxy. They have some different practices as well. But then there are other sects within Islam as well. But the Shia are a minority, but they're a large minority. And I was raised as a Shia. And I had this crazy idea that things are not relatively true, they're actually objectively true. And that if Islam is true, and I thought it was, then you should believe it, because you should believe true things and not false things. That's the goal of life, isn't it? To believe as many true things as possible and to avoid as many false things as possible. And I thought Islam was true, I thought it was the cat's whiskers, and you need to believe it. And I believed this from an early age. I was studying Islamic history and doctrine and theology to whatever capacity I could when I was young, but then through middle school and high school and in college and all these things, I was studying these things. People from all walks of life would ask me questions, whether they're Muslim or non-Muslim, about what Islam was. Now, when I grew up in the Detroit area, in the suburb I grew up in, it was largely homogenous, very, very white. We were exotic. This is way before 9/11, so we were like, oh, you Muslims, look how cute you guys are. What do you guys believe? You know, we were like exotic and cool. That's just interesting. Then 9/11 happens, and all of a sudden, attitudes change. But back then, it was an avenue for me to share my faith. Not just the positives about my faith, but also the negatives about other faiths. Why other people were wrong and Islam was right. And I would do this through conversations. It wouldn't be like I was standing on the Quran standing on the corner, thumping my Quran at you. I wasn't doing that. I was just having conversations with people, whether they were casual conversations with friends or I met someone at a party and I wanted to talk with them about their faith or what they believed, whatever it was. Eventually, I would turn the conversation towards my favorite topic, which is God and theology. You see, I'm from the Middle East, and I like to talk about sports and, you know, current events that are shallow and time-passing kind of stuff. But unlike Americans who don't want to talk about two things, religion and politics, I'm from the Middle East, man. What else is there to talk about? So I would engage in this conversation eventually and steer it towards God. But I was also an equal opportunity faith knocker outer ever. It wasn't just Christians I would go after. If you were an atheist or a Buddhist or a Hindu or a Jew or whatever it was, you got to hear from me about why you were wrong and I was right. But I would do it conversationally and in the context of a relationship. But Christians were low-hanging fruit. Because, like I said, people were of varying faiths in the area I grew up in, but largely Christian, at least in name only. See, I also had this mistaken belief that if you said you were a Christian, you would mean it. That it actually meant something to you. Because in the East and in the Middle East, if you say you're a certain religious belief, it means something to you. Now, you might not practice it even a lick, and you might not do anything. In other words, if it was a crime to be a Muslim, you couldn't be convicted of it because there's no evidence. But that same person who doesn't practice their beliefs whatsoever, if they were to get involved with you in a conversation on theology, they would get involved in a verbal slug match with you over why they were right and you were wrong. And you're wondering, why in the world do you care so much to defend a worldview you yourself don't practice? And here's the reason. Because in the East and the Middle East, it's not just a label. It's who you are. It's a communal aspect to it. There's an identity aspect to it. One of the biggest things for me was the fact that Islam was a part of my identity. There's a colleague who's, Sam Solomon is his name. He's a former Muslim as well. And he gives a great illustration of this. He says, if you were to draw a circle with a dot in the middle of it, in the West, the circle is you. A little tiny dot is religious identity and expression. But in the East, it's exactly the opposite. In the East and in the Middle East, the circle is religious and cultural identity, and the dot is you. You are a much bigger, you are a small part of a much bigger thing that's bigger than you. And so it permeates everything about you. Even if you don't practice it, you still have to identify with it, because otherwise it's a betrayal, not only of yourself, but also of your community and of your family. So I naturally assumed that if you were white and not Jewish, that meant you were a Christian. I had this mistaken belief because I found out quickly during my conversations that most people weren't actually very serious about their Christianity. Because I would start my conversations off in some respect. At some point, I'd ask this question. It's a question you each should ask yourself right this second. It's a rhetorical question, so don't shout out loud. But here's the question I would ask, some form of this question. Why are you a Christian? Why? The most common answer I would get was this. Well, we go to the Presbyterian church on Christmas and Easter, so I guess I'm a Presbyterian, right? I'm like, was that a question or was that an answer? I wasn't sure what you just gave me. Your convictions are lacking quite a bit here. And so I wanted to know, what was it that you actually believe? Why do you believe what you believe? And they'd say, well, tradition. I was raised that way. Or I think I'm a Christian because of whatever sort of reason that they said they were, but they weren't all that convicted about it. So I had a follow-up question. I said, let me understand this correctly. You were raised this way, and so you believe this, but let me ask you a further question. Are you telling me that you're trusting your eternal soul to a religion that somebody else believes? Have you thought this through? Or do you just accept it because you're supposed to? And now their eyes get a little wider. And now they're a little stunned because they realize they've bought into something that maybe they haven't thought through. Could be wrong, could be right. They don't know. They haven't even thought about it. And now with that sort of credulity built into them, I begin to introduce my arguments against the gospel, against whatever it was. Like I said, didn't matter what religion you were. If it was not Muslim, you got to hear from me. So I would introduce those arguments now, and I'd say things like this. I'd say, don't you know that your own scriptures have been corrupted? Muslims believe that the Bible was once parts of the Bible. For instance, the Torah, the five books of Moses, the Injil, the gospel of Jesus, and the Zabur, the Psalms of David, were all once God's revelation, but became corrupted over time to include blasphemous lies according to Islam, like the Trinity and the incarnation of God in Christ and the atoning death on the cross and resurrection. The very heart of Christianity is considered a corruption by Islam. So I'd say that book's been changed. Don't you know that? And don't you know even your own scholars, even your own Christian scholars would agree with me? And I'd quote Bart Ehrman. If you know who Bart Ehrman is, the reason why I quoted him is because he's white and not Jewish, so he's a Christian. Now, Bart is, of course, was an evangelical, but became an agnostic because he had a sort of a very strange view of inerrancy of the Bible. But he's written the same book 18 different times, they all say the same thing. The Bible's been changed. So I would use that information against my Christian friends. And now their eyes get a little wide. Like, oh my goodness, maybe this isn't so trustworthy after all. Maybe it didn't just drop out of the sky into King James's lap, and he said, here you go. Maybe that didn't happen after all. And they would begin to wonder about what this is all about. Then I'd say these things like the Trinity, incarnation, and the atonement. You all believe this is fundamental to your faith. Now, I hear you guys talking all the time about how great God is. And you guys hear, you sing these hymns and all these things about God's greatness. But I don't think your God is very great at all. And it's like, well, why? And I'd say, well, the Trinity. Take a look at the Trinity, for example. First of all, it makes no sense. Second of all, defend it for me. Tell me what it even is. Almost nothing, though. Crickets. I could almost hear nothing from these people. I'm sure you guys can defend it just fine, but I'm telling you, the people would say, it's like a cracked mirror, or it's like water, or it's... Don't use the analogies. Don't do it. If you do it, stop it. but I would say, but wait a minute. Hold on a second. How are you not a confused tritheist? You think you're a monotheist, but you're really just a confused tritheist because God the Father is God, God the Son is God, God the Holy Spirit is God. Sounds like three gods to me. Can you tell me how I'm wrong? And now they would have a hard time responding to this. And I'd say, but one more thing. If God the Father is God and God the Son is God, why does God the Father need help? If God the Son is God and God the Father is God and God needs help, then he's not great. And I would offer that objection. Nothing back. Except for a wide-eyed, oh my goodness. Then I'd say, oh, by the way, this idea that the God of the universe, the God of all creation, this is the one who encapsulates himself into a human form, walks the earth, gets tired feet, sweats, and then eventually dies at the hands of the very sinners he created? And you're telling me this God is great? Almost nothing back. So you create that vacuum. And I wouldn't do it obnoxiously. It would be gradual. But you create that vacuum, and then I'd offer what I thought was the evidence of Islam, the unchanging nature of the Quran, the beauty of Islam, and all these things. And I was good at this. I was very good at this. There were people who are close friends today, actually, who started reading the Quran as God's word, would fast Ramadan with me, would go to prayers and all these things. I was good at this. But there was, once in a while, the occasional annoying Christian who knew what they were talking about. You see, I'm a debater at heart. I'm sort of an advocate. I was a trial lawyer because I have this sort of, if I think something's true and I think it's worth defending, I defend it. And I had that sort of penchant within me. So I have to win my debates, thank you very much. And if you just rolled over and died, be fine with me. But these couple of people who were annoying, they weren't annoying because of their mannerisms, although a couple of them were, I guess. But most of them weren't. Most of them were actually very amicable and amiable, and we had great conversations. But they refused to just lay down. They'd actually not only answer my objections, but they'd offer a few of their own. And I found that terribly annoying. So I started to really look at Christianity and say, okay, this is a little bit more difficult than responding to my atheistic friends or responding to people of differing faiths or whatever it is. This is one that seemed to be tougher. So I began to study these things. And I went to the University of Michigan and I took a lot of comparative religion courses, along with my psychology courses and my pre-med courses. And I began to see something. See, I began to see both sides of the argument. I saw the conservative side, but I also saw the liberal side. Because my professor of New Testament, his name was Jarl Fossum, an honest-to-goodness, actual New Testament scholar, I think is Swedish, and the only reason I think that is because he's like the chef from the Muppets. but a good scholar gave me both sides, but I took the liberal side, and I said, ah, this is my ammunition. I'm going to use this against Christians. Well, it was in my undergraduate days at the University of Michigan when two men came to my door in my apartment complex. Two Baptist guys from down the street, they were going door to door at the apartment complexes in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And if you know what Ann Arbor, Michigan's like, you know it's like Berkeley, California, but cold. It's just really liberal and anti-anything conservative religion, especially not establishment religion like Christianity, right? So a lot of people would slam the door in their face. Slam, slam, or they would yell at them or something like that. They came to my door, you know, knock, 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 open it up. Two Baptist guys standing in suits looking really nice. One guy was super tall and thin and had almost no hair whatsoever. The other guy was a short guy who had hair coming out of everywhere, like a walking number 10. They come over to my apartment, open the door, and said, we're from the Baptist church down the street. Want to talk to you about Jesus. And I'm like, you guys deliver? Come on in. I made those two gentlemen very uncomfortable for hours at a time. But here's the interesting thing. Those two guys kept coming back to my apartment every Thursday. Unless I had like a test or an exam, they'd come back over and over again. Sometimes they had an answer for my question. Sometimes they had a question of their own to ask me. And sometimes they gave somebody the best answer you can give somebody because it's honest. I don't know, but I'll get back to you. And then they did. They went ahead and did that. They'd bring me back something. Here's a scientist talking about the way Genesis actually worked and how it lines up with cosmology. Here's another thing about this theological point you brought up, whatever. They kept coming back. They were like no matter how many times I would give an objection and knock them down, like the Terminator, they would kind of like lumber back up and come back at me. I'm like, you guys are indestructible. What's with you? Here's the interesting thing. I knew these two men loved me. They didn't come to win an argument with a guy. They loved me. They wanted me to go to heaven. And you know what? I loved them back, and I wanted them to go to the paradise that God had prepared for them. So I was talking about Islam. They were talking about Christianity. A bit at loggerheads, but we shared the common goal of loving each other. And they didn't see me as some terrorist to be afraid of or whatever it is. And I got news for you, friends. Yes, we can't be naive about things and think that Islam doesn't have its share of problems. It's got its share of problems. In fact, Muslims from the Clarion Project will tell you that there is in a video called The Slam by the Numbers. Not me saying it, they're saying it. There's something we have to address here. And we can't be naive about it. We can't be naive about it. But let me just tell you this. You can't be terrified of it either. Because by far, the majority of Muslims in this country, or in the world, really, are not sitting behind the stairwell, sort of twisting their mustaches, thinking of ways to blow the place up. They're not doing that. Some of them, sure, some of them are. But chances of you running into one of those is pretty low. I've never run into one of those. And I know a lot of Muslims. I guess they wouldn't tell me, right? They wouldn't tell me up front. But I've never run into one. I've never run into one. They're just people who want to get a job, find the right girl, have babies with that girl, have those babies have babies so they can become grandparents, and then die happy people. Does that sound familiar? So these two men saw me that way. And they would engage in conversation, and it was a good conversation. But I wanted to find something, some little something, a contradiction in the Bible that was consequential, that was important, and that they couldn't respond to. In other words, knock them down and keep them down. So I was walking down the street, and I happened to see these Gideons who actually were handing out Bibles, and I walked by. They were actually unpacking the boxes as I was walking by, and I said, hey, can I have one of those Bibles? They said, sure. Tried to convert the Gideon to Islam. It didn't work, but I tried. took that little Bible. I still have that little Bible, by the way. Walked back to my apartment complex, opened it up, and read, tried to find something in it that I could change these guys' minds with. Some contradiction. Well, I came across a passage in Scripture that was terribly, terribly important, incredibly profound. You almost never hear a sermon on this passage at all, but it's incredibly profound. Luke chapter 3, verses 7 and following. And there's a parallel account in Matthew's gospel. And in that section, people are coming to be baptized by John the Baptist, and he makes some interesting questions to them, and then some statements as well. He says, who told you to flee from the wrath to come? Meaning, of course, God's judgment. And then he says this, do not even begin to think to yourself you have Abraham as your father, for I tell you, God can raise up sons of Abraham from the stones. Do you hear what he's saying? It's terribly important you understand this. He's saying, you have come here, but you understand God's wrath is coming, and you're relying on your lineage, your birth, your DNA, your tradition to save you. Truth trumps tradition. So he's saying, you know who'd been saying that? Me. That's what I was saying. Christians were engaging in discussions with me, and I'd say, why are you a Christian? They'd say tradition. I'd say not good enough. John the Baptist was agreeing with me. Tradition is not good enough. Now, you can be born into the right tradition. That's perfectly legitimate. But I needed to have a knowledge of this stuff, and I was demanding that of the Christians. You know what's funny? In all those times when I had asked Christians, why are you a Christian? They say tradition, and I'd say not good enough. Then I'd launch into my attacks. I didn't allow them the possibility of ever asking me, why are you a Muslim? They were always on their heels. I believe through the power of the Holy Spirit, honestly, preserving God's word over the course of 20 centuries so that it can be printed by Gideons, given to a Muslim man. We can go back to his hotel, his apartment complex, open it up and read the words to ask him, why are you what you are? Never been asked that before. It was John the Baptist who did it. 20 centuries waiting to ask me that. You know, as an aside, friends, you'll hear from the great speakers, Ryan Anderson, Brett Kunkel, Christopher Yuan, the others who have been here, Jim Wallace, other people who have been here, some great arguments and some great reasons to believe and why you should believe is be a Christian. And they're all going to be eloquent. My boss is one of the most eloquent people in the world, Ravi Zacharias. But he'll tell you in a heartbeat he's never going to compare to the eloquence of the Bible or to the persuasiveness of that book. It spoke to a young Muslim man who did not want to believe it in that chair. May you never speak with lofty arguments in a closed Bible. Use those arguments, but that Bible is more important. So what happened in that chair was not that I converted to Christ. That didn't happen for a long time after that. 9 more years would have to transpire before that. But what did happen was my mindset shifted slightly. I went from someone who swallowed whatever people would tell me about Islam in a positive sense, and I would swallow whatever anybody would criticize about Christianity in a negative sense. I would just swallow it and say, that's got to be the truth. I wasn't being critical about things. I decided, because of John the Baptist's statements, believe it because it's true, not because it's tradition. I realized something. I was believing it largely, although I had my evidence, I had my reasons. My largest reason was because of tradition. I was born and raised that way. And you just don't change. So what his words did was shift my mindset just a little bit. Just a little bit. So that I would now try to be more objective. That I wouldn't just swallow whatever I heard that helped to confirm my biases, but I'd actually look at it as objectively as I possibly could. It's a slight shift, but a slight shift. If you know anything about how ships steer across the large open seas, you know a slight shift can result in something amazing. If you're leaving New York and you want to go to Portugal and your course is off by 5 to 10 degrees and you leave port, a mile off, you're not that bad. 5 miles off, you're wider now. 10 miles off, you're in trouble. 100 miles off, now you're lost. Cross the Atlantic Ocean and you're not going to Portugal, you're going to the West Africa. A different destination altogether. And John's words, recorded in Luke and in Matthew, did that for me. So I was fully convinced that Islam was true still, and I thought that if I put these things to the test, Islam and every other worldview, Islam, I was very confident Islam would win. I had zero real doubt about that. That's why I was so brazenly really willing to do it. So I began to do it, and it's along this time when my mind was slightly shifted that I was challenged in my beliefs about Christianity and Islam. From a surprising challenger, a challenger out of nowhere that rocked everything I had come to believe. Now, this challenger was so surprising to me because I had actually put my faith in this challenger. This is the this very challenger to my faith was once the source of the faith I had. And it wasn't a Muslim, it wasn't some imam I knew, it was the Quran. It was the holy book of the Muslims that suddenly challenged everything I had come to believe about the Bible and about Islam itself. Here's how. As I said before, Muslims believe that the parts of the Bible, the Injil, the Gospel of Jesus, the Torah, the five books of Moses, and the Zabur, the Psalms of David, were once revelations from God, but became corrupted over time. And the Quran was revealed in the 7th century to correct, at least in part, to correct all the corruptions and bring us back to true monotheism. So you get the sequence, revelation of the parts of the Bible, corruption of the Bible, Quran's revelation. So I believed that. But then I read something with this new mindset in my mind. I had read a verse of the Quran that I had read many times before. And suddenly I saw it differently. I saw it truly, actually. In the 5th chapter of the Quran, Al-Ma'idah, chapter 5, verses 46 and 47 in the context, but I'll quote one specifically. It says, "Wal yahkum ahlul injil bima anzalallahu fihi. Wa man lam yahkum bima anzalallahu that ulaika hum al-fasiqun." Well, yahkum is a command. It says judge. It's a command, present tense imperative. You judge right now. O people of the gospel, you judge by what God has revealed therein. In other words, in the gospel. And if you don't, you're rebellious. Hold on a second. Wait a minute. If the Quran came to fix the corruptions, why is the Quran telling Muslims to obey, telling Christians to obey and judge by the gospel? It's been corrupted. Why would God say that? Then you look at the same chapter, chapter 5, verse 68. It says, "O people of the book," meaning Christians and Jews, "you have no foundation." The words literally are "lestum ala shay'an," which means you are on nothing unless you observe, present tense, yuqimu, present tense, the gospel and the Torah and all that has been revealed to you from your Lord. Do you see the problem? How could they present tense observe the gospel in the Torah if it's been corrupted and changed? Now, those are just two examples, and there are many examples. I could go on and on about this, about how the Quran affirms the validity of the Bible as God's revelation that is, at the present time, in 7th century, was still extant and available to be judged by and to be a foundation for faith. So how could it possibly be corrupted? If God is a God of order and makes sense and it can be trusted, why would he tell people to judge by a book that contains blasphemous lies? He wouldn't do that. It doesn't make any sense. So this is what Al Gore calls an inconvenient truth. Because the problem here is that The Quran is saying the Bible is an authority, but the Bible and the Quran don't agree on fundamental issues. Yes, there's one God. Yes, that God is great, and I'll get to that later. And these are some important issues, but on these issues, the triunity of God, the Bible affirms it, the Quran denies it. The deity of Christ, that he is God himself, the Bible affirms it, the Quran denies it. The death by crucifixion and the resurrection of Christ, you can't get a Bible, you can't get a gospel without that. And the Quran specifically denies those things. So if the Quran is saying the Bible is right, and the Bible contradicts the Quran, there's a problem because the Quran said that's the authority. But if the Quran says the Bible is right and the Bible is wrong, the Quran is still wrong because it said the Bible was right. So you see the conundrum I'm facing? How do you deal with that? What do you do? Well, I'm, so like I said, I'm a bit of a lawyer by sort of, this is before I became a lawyer, but I wanted to find a loophole. That's what I do. I find good loopholes. Maybe the Bible wasn't corrupted before the Quran. Maybe the differences between the Quran and the Bible occurred because the Bible was corrupted after the Quran's revelation. That will get me out of this mess. So we're going to look at the history. We're going to look at the manuscript evidence for the Bible. The deep one scholar calls it an embarrassment of riches in terms of the New Testament alone. We have nearly 5,000 copies, maybe even over that now, because we're finding new manuscripts all the time of the Gospels in Greek. The New Testament, I should say, not just the Gospels, but all the corpus of the New Testament. In Greek alone, some date, the John Rollins Papyrus, for example, is a little postage stamp fragment of the Gospel of John, the last Gospel written. Many said it was written in the 200s. Then they discovered the John Rollins Papyrus, a piece of John 18, which is dated between 95 AD and 150 AD. So it couldn't have been written after that because copies come on after the originals. That's kind of how it works. So all that scholarship to the flames, one little piece of paper. That's the last gospel written. If the last gospel written was written then how much earlier were Luke, Matthew, and Mark? Not to mention Paul's letters. In fact, think about this. If when you read Luke, and everyone agrees that Luke is the writer of both Luke and Acts, or the writer of Luke is the same writer of Acts, the book of Acts. Acts is the sequel. When you look at Acts, what does it chronicle? It's the Acts of the Apostles. So it chronicles basically central characters, many of the apostles, but two in specific, Peter and Paul. It chronicles all of Paul's hardships, all of his shipwrecks, all of his trials and travails. What does it not record? His death. Now, if you're writing a biography of a famous person or someone, you included every bad thing that happened to him, but not his death, under the Emperor Nero, because he was a Christian, what would you conclude? That it was written before his death. When did he die? A.D. 64. We know that as a matter of history. That means Acts was written before A.D. 64. That also means that Luke was written even before that. And because Luke also uses his source material, Mark, that Mark was written even before that. We're talking in the 50s, maybe even earlier than that. And Jesus dies in 30, 33, a mere 17 to 20-year gap. It's been 15 years since 9/11. Do you remember that day? You remember who you talked to that day, don't you? 15 years is a blink. Especially when you see someone rise from the dead, that tends to stick in your brain. So you see all this manuscript evidence, the 5,000 copies in Greek, the 25,000 copies or thereabouts in Greek and other languages, the Dead Sea Scrolls that affirm so much of the Old Testament, all this, you see the evidence. See, the inconvenient truth got a little more inconvenient for me because the problem was that the evidence showed not only was the Bible intact before the Quran came, but it was intact far after the Quran came. It's always been exactly or largely the same as we have it today, save for some spelling errors and what are called viable variants, which I can get into later. So the evidence gets a little bit more hard to deal with. But there's also a fundamental issue, and I'm going to go into this in my second session if I have the time to do that, and I want to race through this stuff. I don't want to be too verbose. Muslims believe in a foundational doctrine of Islam from which all other doctrines flow. You've heard this phrase, right? Allahu Akbar, you've heard that phrase. Don't get nervous. The Arab guy said Allahu Akbar in the crowd. Don't worry. The reason why I say that, I'm making a joke sort of, but here's the thing. You always hear it in a context of something bad because you always hear it in the news. And some terrorist says it and something bad happens, right? The reality is this, though. Peaceful, loving Muslims will say Allahu Akbar all the time. It literally means God is greater. They say it when they walk into a home, whether it's a Muslim home or a non-Muslim home. Allahu Akbar, look at how great he has blessed you. If they get bad news, like a bad health report, they'll say, Allahu Akbar, God is greater than this. God's greatness is the central doctrine of all of Islam. Now, if God is great, if he's truly great in all his great-making properties, then he would have at least two qualities among the many. He'd be omnipotent, all-powerful, and he'd be trustworthy. If he's not omnipotent, then he's like us, or like Zeus, or like Artemis, you know, kind of powerful, but not really. Why worship that kind of a god? And every Muslim believes he is omnipotent, he is all-powerful. He'd also be trustworthy, because if he's not trustworthy, then why believe anything he says? If he says, I'm going to preserve the Quran, why would you believe that? If he's not trustworthy, he could lie to you. He could totally have told you it's preserved, and it's not. Until you believe this, because it'll get you to heaven. But he's lying. It gets you to hell, actually. So you have to believe he's trustworthy. Otherwise, just chuck it, because if he's lying to you, how are you going to know? So he's got to be all-powerful. He's got to be trustworthy to be great, right? At least those two things. Here's the problem, the theological problem. If God is, if the Bible was once God's revelation, the Torah, Zabur, and Injil, if they were once God's revelation but became corrupted, only two things follow. Either he couldn't protect his word from corruption, or he wouldn't. There is no third option. I looked for 9 years. If you can think of one, I'd love to hear it later. If he couldn't protect his word from corruption, that means he's not all-powerful, and human beings are more powerful than he is. If he's not all-powerful, then he's not great. If he's not great, then why worship him? And no Muslim would ever agree with that first option. Of course, he could protect his word because he's powerful. But is option B any better? He could have, but chose not to? Think about what his revelation actually is. His scriptures are the only way you know who he is, what he wants from you, and what he expects. Right? We can look at the nature and see that there is a God. I think that the nature makes it abundantly clear there is a God. But the revelations actually tell you who he is and what he likes and what he wants and what he thinks of you. Now, if that becomes corrupted so that you can never really know that, and you're led astray to believe blasphemous lies, and you believe those blasphemies willingly, it's his fault. Because he could have stopped it, but chose not to. Unlike evil, evil exists in the world, and God could stop it. At some point, he could stop it, but chooses not to for some greater possible purpose. But that greater possible purpose never includes lying to you about who he is. But if he lets the scripture become corrupted, then you can never know who he is. And if he's not trustworthy enough to keep his scripture, then why believe he keeps the Quran or anything he says? He would not be great. If he's not great, he's not worthy of your worship. In either instance, if he couldn't protect it or he wouldn't protect it, then he's not great. But every Muslim believes, Allahu Akbar, now God is not only great, he is the greatest possible being. If that's the case, then he could, would, and the evidence shows he did preserve his word. So now what do you do with that? What do I do with it? Because these two authorities are contradicting each other. Well, what do you do? Well, you do what any good coward does, because I was recognizing something, that if I make a choice, if I become a Christian, I lose so much. And I won't go into the details about what that would be, but I lose so much, not the least of which, my friends, would be my identity, who I was. It'd be like standing on the edge of a cliff and saying, well, time to jump off. Something dies in that process. And I wasn't willing to do it. Subconsciously, wasn't totally aware of it, but subconsciously that was the case. I didn't want to do that. I wasn't willing to die to myself. It's funny, a Jewish guy who's pretty famous said something about needing to die to yourself. And I wasn't willing to do it. It's Jesus, by the way, for the slow of you. I wasn't willing to do that. And so what I did was I took the words of the Quran and the words of the Bible, and when they disagreed, I tried to harmonize them and make them say the same thing. So when the Bible says, when Jesus says, I and the Father are one, in John. I'm like, well, you know what? That doesn't mean they're one and the same in their nature. That means that they're one and the same in their mission, in their desire, in their message. So I'm going to play with the words a little bit here. But the Quran says, مَا قَتَلُهُ وَمَا صَلَّبُهُ لَكِنْ شُبِهَ لَهُمْ, which means in Arabic, they did not kill him, nor did they crucify him, but it looked like it to them. Well, what do you do with that? Because you look at the Gospels, and if you get rid of the passion narrative and the resurrection narrative, half of Luke gone, a quarter of John gone, huge parts of Mark just gone. So how can you have those two things reconcile? You see what it says? They did not kill him, nor did they crucify him. And then in Isaiah, you read that it was God's plan to strike the Messiah to save the world. God did it. See what I just did? I played with these words a little bit, and I made a nice little Frankenstein's monster of a faith out of it. If you've ever read the story of Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, you know something. The monster's name is not Frankenstein. The monster has no name. The doctor's name is Frankenstein, and what he wants to do is he takes dead things, sews them together, runs a current through it, and creates life, or at least pseudo-life. But the monster has no identity of its own. It does not know what it is, and so it hates everyone who does and goes on this kill-crazy rampage. You take these dead things, you sew them together, you think you're such a genius, but all you do is result in death. That's what I was doing. I was taking dead things, a liberal theology here, conglomeration of what I thought was Islam here, after having believed it firmly, now trying to make it fit to what I'd like it to be, putting it together, running a current through it, and calling it life, but it wasn't life at all. It was a Frankenstein's monster. Well, I tried that for a number of years because I didn't want to make a decision. At some point, did not want to lose these things. And I thought, legitimately, I could actually see where everyone else has gone wrong. Somehow, I'm the genius who's going to figure this out, right? It was during this time that some friends invited me to church. And I don't know why, but I said yes. So invite them, because they will say yes. Out of just sheer curiosity sometimes. Well, I said yes, and I got up that morning. It was a sunny morning, gorgeous sunny morning in the summer. I got up super early, actually. My friends were coming to pick me up and take me to church. I got up early, and I had my Bible and my Quran sticky-tabbed and color-coded where they disagreed. And I was trying to make one of those things agree without over-rationalizing it, because I knew I was doing that. I was going to try to not over-rationalize it and make at least one of those things match up before I went to this church and got challenged. I wanted to at least do it on one of them, and I couldn't do it. For 2 hours, early in the morning, couldn't do it, and that got me upset. So I walk out to the car, my friends are there, I get in the car, and I'm quiet, which is not usual. And they said to me, what's wrong? Are you okay? I said, yeah, it's sunny outside and beautiful. It's a sunny morning. Let's go outside and do something fun. We're going to go ahead and stay in the building for 2 more hours for. No, you promised. You said you're going to church. I said, okay, fine. I'll go. So I went. I walked into that church service, and I remember everything about it. It was at a high school in my hometown, which made all my friends from high school say, what are you doing here? You know, that kind of thing. Well, I walked in, and I remember the song that was playing when I walked in the service. I remember where we sat. I remember what the seats looked like, the color of the seats. I remember everything about it because I had that experience. And if you're a Christian and you're in this room, maybe you've had this experience too, where you walk into the church service, you sit down, you got your own stuff going on, but for some reason the pastor's talking to you. And the reaction says that you've had that experience. Now, when you walk out of that church service, you're pumped up, you're ready to go, you're convicted, something's happening, you're making a change, whatever it is, and you're excited about it. Well, that happened to me that day, and I wasn't the least bit happy about it. Because here's what he said. After the whole sermon, he said, God has been leaning on the door for your whole life. And if you would just stop leaning back, the door will slam open, he will clean every room in your house. Is that you? And I knew it was me. I just knew it. Now I'm even more quiet. And we walk outside, and I'm walking next to the person who's now my wife, the mother of my lovely Lulu. I'm walking out. My friends who invited me also are in front of me, a couple steps ahead, out into this gorgeous sunny day in this parking lot. Now, I'm Lebanese, so I get fiery and emotional, but I'm not going to cry in front of a woman. I'm too macho and too Middle Eastern for that. But I did. but it wasn't just a cry, friends. It was an actual outright sob. in the parking lot. I'm sobbing in the parking lot, and I'm feeling this weight push on my shoulders, and I'm hunching over. I can't stand up straight. I can't stand up straight. This weight is pushing on. When I close my eyes, I can see these enormous books on the top of my shoulders, and I'm holding them up like Atlas holding up the world, but I'm not Atlas, and they're crushing me. And I'm saying out loud in the middle of the sobs, I can't do it. It's too heavy. The burden's too much. They don't agree. I can't do it. I can't do it. Now I'm weeping. Nicole is crying. She's thinking, he's enormous. If he falls down, who's going to help? But now this is the part of the story where the guy says that I became a believer that day, right in the parking lot. Didn't happen. What did happen was this, though. I realized that I had been building this fence that I had sat on all this time, and I hate this fence. I hate it. Because it wasn't one of those nice fences you can sit on, you know, like a flat thing where you can, you know, sit and just kind of enjoy the day. It was a chain link fence, you know, with the points on top. So no matter how you sit, it hurts. You shift, no help. Well, I hate this fence that I'm sitting on, and I want to tear it apart link by link. And I made a determination that very day, I'm going to tear it apart if it takes the last thing out of me. So I graduated law school, passed the bar exam. I had signed on to my first job at a big, big law firm. And all my friends were either at work or at school, and it was months before my job would start, so I had all this time on my hands. Everyone was already gone and doing something else, so I had all kind of time on my hands. So I made it my goal, my effort, to study Islam and Christianity specifically, but many worldviews in general, 8 hours a day. That's what I was doing. I remember sitting at the desk in my parents' home with, on the left side of my desk was all my evidence for Islam, articles and books and emails from scholars and various things, stacked as high as my eye. On the right side of the desk was all my evidence for the gospel, the historicity of the gospel, and specifically the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus as a matter of fact, not a matter of hope. It's piled right there. Behind me on the computer was playing a debate over the internet. This is back in the dial-up days when you got on the internet and it yelled at you for it. You know, remember that? And some of you are going, what is he talking about? Because you're a little, either you're too old or you're too young to remember that. But on that computer was a debate between a Muslim and a Christian about whether Jesus rose from the dead. I was literally surrounded by the evidence, literally surrounded by it. And I had intellectually assented. I knew now that this Bible was trustworthy. This Bible had been faithfully transmitted down through the centuries. And in that Bible, in that trustworthy historical document, a man named Jesus claimed to be the Son of God who takes away the sins of the world. And by his death, he would take that sin for us. In his resurrection, we would have life. And his resurrection, the historical resurrection, proved he was right. I intellectually assented to all of that. I knew it was true. But I wouldn't embrace it as true. And there's a difference. I began to ask why. I actually started to pray. God, why? Why can't I accept it? I know it's true. It's obviously true now. In my mind, it's solidified. Why can't I embrace it? Why? Why? And then the answer walked by. Literally walked by. My dad walked by. He looked at me. Studying. Education. Furthering your mind. So proud. How do you plunge your hand into his chest and pull his heart out and show it to him? How do you do that? It would destroy him. It would destroy everybody. I knew right then and there, it wasn't that I couldn't believe, it's that I wouldn't. Because of the consequences. See, friends, this is a truism. I don't care what walk of life you come from, what faith or lack of faith you come from. I firmly believe, convinced of this truth. The answers are not hard to find. They are hard to accept. I knew that was the reason. It was over the course of some weeks and some months following that day that I found myself reading the Bible no longer just to find out if it's true, but now for comfort. This Jesus of Nazareth was so compelling. In every shape and way of his life, I had a problem, I would turn to Jesus for it. If I had an issue, I would look what the Bible had to say about it. And I began to think to myself, these are the words of life. But there it was. I remember where I was when I read the words. Romans chapter 5, verse 8. The God that I was looking for in Islam, I found in the gospel. You see, I believed Allahu Akbar, right? God is greater. He's the greatest possible being. That means he would express the greatest possible ethic in the greatest possible way. That stands to reason. What is the greatest ethic? It's love. Every other ethic of justice, of mercy, of compassion, of guidance, of kindness, all of these ethics flow from love. So the greatest ethic is love. And the greatest possible being would express it. But he wouldn't just express it, he would express it in the greatest possible way. What is the greatest possible way to express love? Is it to give someone a book of guidance and rules? That could be loving, not the greatest way. Is it to give someone a nice gift and surprise them at work with a sweet word or a word of encouragement? That's loving, but it's kind of about you too, because you get to be the guy who did it. No, if you have a relationship in this room and you know you do, or if you've lost one and you mourn its loss, you know something about that relationship. You know it's true and it means something, and love is pure because the person who loves you sacrificed for you. True love gives when it hurts you and helps the other person. The greatest possible way to express love is self-sacrifice. Now, you and I can do that. And those of you who have been in some kind of a service industry, whether it's the military or it's through the law enforcement or public service of firefighting or whatever it might be, or those of you who are just average Joes and average Janes who have done something to help someone who doesn't, who you don't even know. You know this. You can sacrifice for those who love you and for those who are strangers. But you don't have the inclination to sacrifice for someone who hates you. That's not in your nature. Your love has limits, and so does mine. Romans chapter 5, verse 8, the God who is great, not just great as we are, but greater because he is pure and we are not. The God who is greater loves better than we do. Romans chapter 5, verse 8, for God shows his love, his greater love, in that while we were sinners, God-haters, Christ died for us. The greatest possible being expressing the greatest possible ethic in the greatest possible way. And friends, I'll tell you this. I've looked everywhere, and there's nowhere other than the cross where that happens. If God is great, that's him. That's him. When I realized that, everything I could lose was nothing compared to who I would gain. And then God made me a son from a stone. Thank you, guys.